Annie's refusal to consent to polygamy didn't deter Kenyon, however. Openly and aggressively, he began to pursue a particularly alluring girl coveted by many men in Bountiful, Allaire, the adopted daughter of Kenyon's uncle Ray Blackmore, who was the community's presiding bishop. Kenyon's amorous advances, which had not been sanctioned by either the bishop in Bountiful or the prophet in Colorado City, enraged Ray, who ordered his sons to chase Kenyon out of town, after which Allaire was married to Ray, her own father. 4 years after Ray Blackmore married his adopted daughter Allaire, he took Debbie Palmer, the woman who burned down her own house in Bountiful, as yet another plural wife. For the next decade and a half, Kenyon shuffled his growing family around Western North America, scraping by as a ranch hand, a leather worker, and a carpenter, never settling in any one place for more than a year or two. Annie gradually began to understand, she says, that the kids and I didn't mean that much to him. Ken did whatever he wanted, with whoever he wanted, whenever he wanted. He'd go away for weeks at a time, wouldn't ever call, wouldn't tell me where he was. Annie and Kenyon's oldest child, Lena, who is now 42, confirms that he was a bad father. "Dad is a mean son of a bitch," she says bluntly, although it took me until I was in my 30s to really see who he was. "He's a mean, mean man who doesn't care about anybody but himself." Kenyon was physically abusive to all his children, but he was especially vicious to Lena. When she was 11, he grabbed a heavy tractor fan belt and gave her a particularly brutal whipping for no reason at all that I could tell, Lena remembers. We were living in Las Cruces, New Mexico. I still have the scars on the backs of my legs. In the early 1980s, Kenyon's fortune seemed to take an upward turn. He moved his family to the pious community of Salem in Utah County, where he entered into a business partnership with an affable Mormon named Bernard Brady. Kenyon converted Brady to fundamentalism. The two men began selling shares in tax-sheltered financial trusts, and as a side venture, they invested in the legendary Dream Mine, which dominated the mountainside above Salem. Soon millions of dollars were flowing into the Blackmore-Brady business account. Each man bought a lavish home below the Dream Mine. Life was good. During this period, Kenyon would make frequent sales trips, roaming across Western North America in search of investors. In 1983, during one of these trips, he went to Mexico and secretly married Gwendolyn Stubbs LeBaron, the winsome daughter of Lavina Stubbs and the late Joel LeBaron. Around this time as well, Kenyon introduced Bernard Brady to a longtime friend of his from Canada, the prophet Onias, whom Kenyon had first met when he was working as a schoolteacher in Bountiful 17 years earlier. Onias, who had just moved to Utah County in order to build his city of refuge below the Dream Mine, was in the process of launching his School of the Prophets, and he invited Brady to join. Flattered and grateful, Brady returned the favor by recruiting into the school five brothers from an outstanding Utah County family: Tim, Watson, Mark, Dan, and Ron Lafferty. Not long thereafter, Kenyon's brief fling with good fortune came to a screeching halt. Brenda and Erica Lafferty were murdered in American Fork on July 24, 1984, and right away the police considered Kenyon Blackmore and Bernard Brady to be prime suspects, along with everyone else even remotely associated with the School of the Prophets. But law enforcement officers had actually become well acquainted with Brady and Blackmore long before the Lafferty murders. In 1983, a federal grand jury had indicted Blackmore, Brady, and 19 other partners on multiple counts of fraud, charging them with bilking more than $32 million from 3,800 investors, a swindle described as a classic Ponzi scheme by the United States attorney who prosecuted the case. Utah has been called the fraud capital of the world by the Wall Street Journal, and within the state, no place has more white-collar crime than Utah County. According to FBI agent Jim Malpied, at any given moment the FBI is investigating scams totaling $50 million to $100 million perpetrated by con artists like Kenyon Blackmore, based in the county. The uncommonly high incidence of fraud is a direct consequence of the uncommonly high percentage of Utah County residents who are Mormons. When saints are invited to invest in dubious schemes by other saints, they tend to be overly trusting. Michael Hines, director of enforcement for the Utah Securities Division, told the Deseret News that in Utah County it is common for scammers to ensnare their victims by asking them to evaluate the proposed investment through prayer. People need to realize, Hines warned, that God is not a good investment advisor. Among those who got burned in the scam was Blackmore's new mother-in-law, Lavina Stubbs LeBaron, Gwendolyn's mom. Heaven's sakes alive, Lavina recalls, I lost a lot of money in Kenyon's stupid money program. I sold my house and everything else and gave all the money to him. Every cent of it disappeared. Astonishingly, she doesn't blame Kenyon Blackmore for leaving her penniless. According to Lavina, he meant well. He was trying to benefit all of us, but then the investments just turned bad or something. I wasn't mad at Ken, not for that. Not until he took my daughter and all my grandkids to Central America and did all those horrible things to them. Kenyon's partner in crime, Bernard Brady, was arrested, tried, and eventually sent to federal prison for 6 years. But when Blackmore learned of the indictments, he opted to go into hiding instead of surrendering to the police. He ran straight to Mexico, where Gwendolyn and Lavina were waiting to shelter him in Colonia LeBaron. At this point, Annie Blackmore, Kenyon's first wife, still knew nothing of Gwendolyn, the second wife. God had commanded Ken not to tell me about her, Annie says bitterly. The only reason I found out he had married her is because I went down to Mexico to try and talk him into coming back to Utah. It proved to be an exceedingly humiliating experience for Annie. Not only did she discover that Kenyon had a new wife who was the same age as their oldest daughter, but this young woman had just given birth to a baby daughter of her own with Kenyon. Delivered in Colonia LeBaron exactly 3 days before Dan Lafferty cut the throats of Brenda and Erica Lafferty, the little girl had been named Evangeline. After failing to persuade Kenyon to return to Utah with her, Annie went back home in utter shock. But she couldn't let herself give up on him. I was committed to the marriage, she says. I didn't want to be a quitter. So in January 1985, she went back to Mexico and again asked Kenyon to come home. And this time he agreed. As soon as he crossed the border into El Paso, Texas, however, Kenyon was surrounded by FBI agents and placed in handcuffs. A brother-in-law, one of the investors who had been swindled by Kenyon, had tipped them off. Seeing no alternative, following his arrest, Kenyon entered into a plea bargain with the government and was incarcerated in a federal lockup in Tallahassee, Florida. After his release from prison in late 1991, Kenyon Blackmore returned to the town where he was born, Cardston, Alberta. Annie had given up on him by this point and filed for divorce, but Kenyon made an effort to reunite with their oldest daughter, Lena, in Cardston, the hub of Canadian Mormondom. Although Lena tried to give her father the benefit of the doubt, she wasn't comfortable around Gwendolyn, the wife who had supplanted her mother, or the two children Gwendolyn had had with Kenyon by this point. It was disturbing to see how my dad and her were raising those kids, Lena says. They had them on some extremely weird natural diet, and Ken wouldn't let them use soap or brush their teeth. The kids looked malnourished and smelled bad. My dad and his wife did, too. They just stunk. It was disgusting. Lena might have been able to put up with all that, but then her father stole her vehicle. I had this nice new truck, she says, and I was having some financial difficulties. So Dad said he'd make the payments for me and pay the insurance if he could use it for a little while. After driving off in Lena's truck, however, Kenyon didn't bother to make any of the promised payments, which she discovered only when the bank threatened to repossess it. Furious, she called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who in turn alerted Kenyon's probation officer, and a warrant was issued for his arrest. Ken discovered he'd bit into the wrong bone this time, Lena says. Upon learning he was wanted by the law again, Kenyon fled south with Gwendolyn and their kids to his old hideaway, Colonia LeBaron. Back in Mexico, Kenyon married a third wife, who happened to be Gwendolyn's half-sister. He departed Colonia LeBaron soon thereafter with both wives and all their children, and lit out across Central America. Over the years that followed, he had four more children with each wife. He supported all these dependents after a fashion by doing odd jobs, selling natural foods, working as a massage therapist, and running petty scams. He got money lots of different ways, says Evangeline Blackmore, the oldest of the kids Ken had with Gwendolyn. Now a tall, blonde, exotic-looking 18-year-old who speaks English with a trace of a Mexican accent, Evangeline explains that Kenyon would buy and sell gold once in a while. When we were in Mexico, he made saddles and other leather goods for Mexican cowboys. But mostly he would con people. My dad is a very good con artist. Kenyon Blackmore had always subscribed to weird religious views, but they became notably more extreme after his release from prison, when he disappeared into the shadows of Central America with his two LeBaron wives. "The LeBarons seemed to encourage Dad's strange beliefs," says Lena. "They were convinced he possessed godlike qualities. They would feed his fantasy, and he would feed theirs." As he dragged his young wives and their pack of semi-feral children back and forth across Central America, Kenyon received a series of revelations in which God told him that he was the last prophet before the return of Jesus Christ. God told him, in fact, that Jesus would come back to earth in the form of a child born of Kenyon's pure seed and his daughter's virgin womb. Heeding the Lord's commandment in June 1996 on Evangeline's 12th birthday, he took her as his wife. That is to say, he began raping her on a regular basis. According to Evangeline, her father believed that he should start having sexual intercourse with her when she turned 12, because this is when Mary, the first mother of Jesus, was impregnated. Kenyon was convinced, she says, that nobody else's blood was good enough to sire the Son of Man. When Kenyon forced himself on Evangeline, she remembers him telling her that I was going to hell because I wasn't being submissive. As she continued to resist, he would throw me on the ground, punch me, and cover my mouth when I would try and scream. Eventually, to keep from being beaten, she started yielding passively to her 60-year-old father's incestuous assaults. I was barely 12 years old, Evangeline states with astounding composure. I didn't know what was happening to me, but I knew I didn't like it. I felt gross. My father wouldn't allow me to have friends or even talk to anybody. During Evangeline's ordeal at her father's hands, Blackmore often fasted and would force his family to fast along with him. He was always going on liquid diets of pure orange juice or lemon water, says Evangeline. He came to believe that if he makes his body pure enough, that he can move mountains and walk through walls. He also believed that almost everyone in the world except himself had been corrupted and was evil. Evangeline recalls Blackmore talking about finding some innocent, naive Indian tribe and converting them to his beliefs, then systematically improving their blood by impregnating their women with his own pure seed. After being raped by her father for the better part of a year, Evangeline became pregnant, but she miscarried the baby 2 months later. In April 1997, when she failed to conceive again, Kenyon cast Evangeline out and abandoned her in Guatemala. She was 2 months shy of her 13th birthday. "I lived by myself for about 4 months," she recalls. "When I ran out of food, I went to stay with some friends in Guatemala City. After about 6 months, these Guatemalan acquaintances managed to contact her grandmother, Lavina, in Colonia LeBaron, and Lavina drove down to Guatemala and rescued her. Evangeline currently lives in the American Midwest. She is married and has a baby son. She's doing well, all things considered, but she's extremely worried about her younger siblings, six of whom are girls, all of them still traveling with Kenyon Blackmore, presumably somewhere in Central or South America. Her father, she reports, intends to marry each of his daughters when they turn 12 years old. I'm concerned about my sisters, Evangeline says. I don't want them getting raped. I'm still not over it. It's something that haunts you. Something that's always there. The oldest of Evangeline's sisters had her 12th birthday in May 2001, the next in February 2003. Another will turn 12 in July 2004. Chapter 22. Reno. Joseph Smith bequeathed his followers a troublesome legacy. The conviction that it was the kingdom or nothing, and the belief that any act that promoted or protected God's work was justified. Some have tried to dismiss Mountain Meadows as an isolated event, an aberration in the otherwise inspiring history of Utah and Mormonism, but it was much more a fulfillment of Smith's radical doctrines. Brigham Young's relentless commitment to the kingdom of God forged a culture of violence from Joseph Smith's theology that bequeathed a vexatious heritage to his successors. Early Mormonism's peculiar obsession with blood and vengeance created the society that made the massacre possible, if not inevitable. These obsessions had devastating consequences for Young's own family. In New York in 1902, William Hooper Young, the prophet's grandson, slit the abdomen of an alleged prostitute and wrote the words, "Blood Atonement," in his father's apartment. Will Bagley, Blood of the Prophets. It was around 2 o'clock on the afternoon of July 24th, 1984, when Dan Lafferty cut Brenda Lafferty's throat and let her life drain across the floor of her kitchen in a viscous crimson flood. Since he'd already killed Brenda's baby, the first half of the removal revelation had been completed. Ron Lafferty then drove Dan, Chip Carnes, and Ricky Knapp to the home of Chloe Lowe, which was located on an unpaved, out-of-the-way street in Highland, Utah. Their immediate plan was to remove Lowe, as God had commanded in the second part of Ron's revelation, then go to the nearby residence of Richard Stowe, president of the Highland LDS stake, and slash his throat as well. Once they'd thus fulfilled the entire commandment, the path would be clear for work to commence on the City of Refuge, which was to be built next to the Dream Mine in preparation for the last days. When they arrived at the Lowe home, Ron parked his Impala station wagon out of sight on a side street, and he and Dan crept up to the house to determine who might be inside. As it happened, nobody was there. The Lowes had gone to their summer home on Bear Lake, up near the Utah-Idaho border, for the Pioneer Day holiday. Ron returned to the car and told Carnes and Knapp, "Well, there ain't nobody here, so we're just gonna rip it off and see if we can find any guns and some money or whatever we can get." After backing the car into the Lowe's carport, Ron grabbed his 20-gauge shotgun and told Carnes to act as a lookout while he and Knapp returned to the house, where Dan was waiting for them. Ron, having been a guest in the Lowe home many, many times over the previous dozen years, knew it well. After removing a window, he, Dan, and Knapp disabled the burglar alarm, entered the house, and ransacked it. While they were inside, two boys from the neighborhood drove up on a noisy all-terrain vehicle. Carnes, who was conspicuously holding a .30-30 Winchester rifle and wearing a ski mask in the suffocating July heat, dove out of the station wagon and hid in some nearby brush as the neighborhood kids approached the front door and then knocked for a long time over and over. Inside the house, Dan and Ron heard the boys knocking but simply ignored it, calmly continuing their search for valuables. After a few minutes, the boys quit pounding on the door and roared away in a cloud of blue smoke. Dan, Ron, and Knapp stole a $100 bill, a watch, car keys, and some jewelry. And then, in an act of spite, Ron destroyed Chloe Lowe's collection of porcelain figurines from Dresden, Germany, which he knew she treasured for sentimental reasons. The burglars exited the home via a back window, packed up Carnes, who was still hiding in the scrub, and drove off. The next item of business on their agenda was the murder of Richard Stowe. Knapp was driving. Ron gave him directions to Stowe's home, but the route was complicated and Knapp missed one of the turns. According to Dan, Ron yelled something to Ricky like, "Hey, that's where we were supposed to turn." But by that point, there wasn't much enthusiasm for continuing to fulfill the revelation right then. The four men briefly discussed whether to turn around and go back to the Stowe home. Carnes, who was growing increasingly anxious, begged Ron to forget about the remainder of the revelation. "If the Lord wanted you to kill someone else today," Carnes pleaded, "you'd already be there." To his surprise and immense relief, Ron concurred without argument and told Knapp to continue in the direction he was heading, which would take them to Interstate 15. Had they turned around and driven to President Stowe's residence that afternoon, they would have found him, unlike Chloe Lowe, at home. He was taking advantage of the holiday to do some work on his house with his son, using a tractor to remove a set of concrete steps. It's impossible to know what would have occurred had the Lafferty brothers gone on to Stowe's property, but considering the number of guns in their possession, it's not difficult to imagine the bloodshed that might have ensued if Ricky Knapp hadn't missed the turn. But he did miss the turn, so instead of going back to kill Stowe, the four men drove on to Salt Lake City, where Knapp exited Interstate 15 and steered the car west onto Interstate 80. As they drove, Dan held the sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun in his lap so it would be ready in case they were pulled over by the police. Their destination was Reno, Nevada. As the Impala sailed down the freeway, Knapp finally mustered the courage to ask Ron and Dan what exactly had happened inside the apartment of Alan and Brenda Lafferty back in American Fork. According to Dan, he described to Knapp in considerable detail how he had killed Brenda and her baby, recounting the murders exactly as he would later recount them in Chapter 16 of this book, which also matches his sworn testimony during a 1996 trial in every important detail. Dan says he made it very clear to Knapp and Carnes that he, not Ron, actually wielded the knife that ended the lives of both Brenda and Erica. But Chip Carnes remembers this episode differently. In his own sworn testimony during the same 1996 trial, Carnes insisted in an entirely believable manner that it was Ron, not Dan, who told Knapp and him about the murders during the long, sweltering drive from Salt Lake to Nevada. And Ron's story differed from Dan's in one crucial regard. According to Carnes, Ron said that as soon as he went in the house, he punched Brenda as hard as he could, and she fell down again on the floor. And he said that he was calling her a bitch and, you know, telling her what he thought about her. And he said that she was begging him and pleading with him, you know, to stop. And he said he just kept beating her and beating her, said she wouldn't go down and stay down. So while he got Dan to hold her on the floor, he said that he got up and cut a vacuum cleaner cord off and proceeded to tie it around her neck, kept it there until Dan told him to let him know that she had went limp. And he said at that time he removed the cord and him and Dan picked her up, took her into the kitchen, laid her on the floor, and cut her throat. He said he cut her from ear to ear, and he demonstrated how. A little bit later on after that, Ron had pulled a knife out of his... removed the knife from his boot. And he started banging it on his knee and said, "I killed her. I killed her. I killed the bitch. I can't believe I killed her." He went on to brag about his knuckle being swelled up, you know, maybe broke, you know, from hitting her. Carnes testified that when Ron boasted of cutting Brenda from ear to ear, he had also described in repugnant detail how after he drew the knife across her throat, he yanked her head back and opened her neck so the blood would flow freely and everything. And he then said he handed the knife to Dan. He turned and he kind of glanced at me, and then he looked back at Dan and said, "Thank you, brother, for doing the baby, because I don't think I had it in me." And Dan replied and said it was no problem. Dan doesn't dispute the essential fact in the last two sentences of Carnes' testimony, but he says the rest of it is fiction. Dan is adamant that he, not Ron, killed Brenda, pointing out that he has no reason to lie about this, unlike Carnes. After the police arrested Carnes, the state told him they would charge him with capital homicide and seek a death sentence unless he provided them with evidence that led to the conviction of both Ron and Dan on first-degree murder charges. If Carnes' testimony turned out to be sufficiently helpful to the prosecution, the state assured him, "We will make you one heck of a deal." Dan Lafferty says he was a little surprised that Chip Carnes misunderstood Ron's involvement in the murders, unless he was encouraged in some way by the prosecution. Or maybe he was just confused. I don't blame Chip either way. It was a pretty intense scenario, and when I explained it in the car to him and Ricky, probably a lot of it didn't make a lot of sense. Perhaps the question of who actually used the knife is a relatively unimportant distinction. When they forced their way into Brenda's apartment in American Fork, the hands of both brothers got bloody, literally and metaphorically. The murders were a team effort. Ron and Dan were equally culpable. A big-hearted young woman and her baby girl were dead, and nothing was going to change that fact as Ron, Dan, Carnes, and Knapp drove west into the blinding white glare of the Bonneville Salt Flats. The fugitives reached the Nevada state line around 6 p.m. As soon as they were out of Utah, they pulled off the interstate and rented a bungalow at a cut-rate motel in the border town of Wendover. It had been a long day. Everybody was tired and frazzled. Dan rinsed out their bloody clothes in the bathtub, and then all four men walked to a cheesy little gambling parlor-come-convenience store where they bought beer and hot dogs to take back to the motel for dinner. Around 11 o'clock, they were sitting around the motel room drinking beer when all of a sudden Ron decided it was time to go, Carnes said. They hastily repacked everything into the Impala and took off, with Knapp at the wheel. Immediately, he saw flashing lights in the rearview mirror. It was the Nevada Highway Patrol. Knapp pulled over and got out of the car to talk to the officer while the others sat with their guns at the ready, prepared to open fire if it looked like the cop had figured out who they were and why they were wanted by the law. But the officer never realized they were fugitives. Instead of attempting to arrest the men, he simply told Knapp that the Impala's taillights were out and that the car was leaking gas. Knapp, betraying nothing, politely assured the officer that they'd get everything fixed right away. The cop told him just to drive the car back across the Utah line and out of his jurisdiction because he didn't want it blowing up in Nevada, and then drove off into the night. The four fugitives let out a collective sigh of relief, then replaced the fuse for the taillights. The fuse blew again as soon as they switched the lights back on, however, so they returned to the motel to wait for daylight. Leaving all their belongings in the car, Ron and Dan lay down to get some rest. But Knapp and Carnes were still way too freaked by their encounter with the policeman to even think about sleeping, so they left the room to buy cigarettes. "We went out walking around," said Carnes. The 23-year-old had a really bad feeling about what was going down. "I told Ricky how I felt about what, you know, I thought was happening, and he told me that he was pretty much feeling the same way." Carnes then confessed to Knapp that he was about to make a run for it. "I'm out of here. As soon as they go to sleep, I'm gone." Carnes and Knapp went back inside the motel room, playing it cool so that Ron and Dan wouldn't suspect that something was up. "As soon as I was sure they were asleep," said Carnes, "I took the keys and told Ricky, 'I'll see you later.' Ricky said, 'Wait a minute, I'm coming with you.'" Carnes and Knapp pushed the Impala far enough down the road so that the brothers wouldn't hear them turning the engine over, then started it up and got the hell out of there. Knapp drove, keeping his foot lightly on the brake pedal so that the brake lights would stay on, thereby preventing them from being pulled over again. They went west on Interstate 80, then turned north on U.S. 93 toward Twin Falls, Idaho, eventually deciding to take a roundabout route, mostly on back roads, to Cheyenne, Wyoming, where Carnes' brother Gary lived. As they drove, they kept finding evidence of the crime in the station wagon: the boning knife used to kill Brenda and Erica, a garbage bag holding the bloody clothes Dan had rinsed out in the motel bathtub, a green suitcase with two straight razors in it, and whenever they came across this stuff, they chucked it out the window. Carnes and Knapp arrived at Gary Carnes' home in Cheyenne on Thursday morning. 4 days later, police spotted the Impala parked out front, raided the house, and arrested them. Because they had been drawn into the Lafferty's orbit and become entangled in the brothers' murderous crusade, the odds were good that both Carnes and Knapp would be convicted and sentenced to death. When the cops explained this to them, they quickly agreed to reveal everything they knew in return for a promise of leniency. Police officers were thereby able to recover the murder weapon as well as most of the other evidence that had been dumped during the fugitives' panic drive across Nevada, Idaho, and Wyoming. Knapp and Carnes also provided detectives with an important lead about the whereabouts of the Lafferty brothers, revealing that they had talked about going to Reno. Bernard Brady, the dream mine investor and business partner of Kenyon Blackmore, who had introduced the Lafferty boys to the prophet Onias, arrived home from work on Wednesday afternoon, July 25th, he remembers, to find all these cop cars in front of my house. Just up and down the street, cop cars everywhere. So I went inside to see what was going on, and my house was filled with cops. My family was seated on the couch, having been told if they moved, they would be shot. They were terrorized. The horde of police officers was literally ripping apart the house looking for evidence. As soon as Brady walked in the door, a grim-faced detective told him to sit down and shut up. Annoyed at being treated as a suspect, Brady asked to see their search warrant. "When they showed it to me," he says, "I noticed they had the address wrong. The warrant authorized them to search an address across the street and a couple of houses down, not my house. So I went over to one of the cops and pointed out that they were conducting an illegal search. He showed it to the sheriff, who came back and insisted it was a valid warrant anyway, and they kept on tearing the house apart." It proved to be a fruitful search. In a drawer, the officers found the affidavit Brady had notarized back on April 9th, stating that he had been shown the removal revelation but wanted to have nothing more to do with it. They also took into evidence some files about the School of the Prophets, as well as the computer on which Ron had typed out most of the revelations he had received, although it did not contain the removal revelation. Soon thereafter, however, the police obtained another search warrant for an unoccupied house where Ron had been squatting before he and Dan embarked on their road trip. One of the closets inside this home yielded a flannel shirt, and in the breast pocket of the shirt was a note written on a sheet of yellow legal paper in Ron's tidy hand. It turned out to be the original copy of the removal revelation. When the Lafferty brothers went to bed in their Wendover motel room late on the night of July 24th, they both fell into a deep sleep. They awoke the following morning to discover that Knapp and Carnes had vanished with the Impala and everything inside it, leaving them flat broke with little more than the clothes they were wearing. Instead of being angry, Dan says, I thought that maybe it was a good thing in some ways. I certainly didn't blame them, all considered, and I was inclined to think it was meant to be because Ron and I had slept so soundly. After pondering their options, Ron suggested they split up, hitchhike across Nevada, and rendezvous in the Reno area at John Esquaga's Nugget, a casino in Sparks they'd visited during their road trip earlier that summer. Dan stuck out his thumb beside the westbound on-ramp to Interstate 80 and was immediately picked up by a trucker in an 18-wheeler who gave him a ride all the way to Reno. He spent that night huddled in a historic steam locomotive on display in a city park, then passed the following day skulking around the Nugget until Ron showed up. After they found each other, Ron and Dan were standing outside the entrance to the casino, Dan says, when this big guy named Bud staggered out and kind of puked a little by the curb, and when he did, his wallet fell to the ground. It was about the fattest wallet I've ever seen. Instead of keeping it, Dan handed the wallet back to Bud, who in gratitude let the brothers sleep on his floor that night, then invited them to go water skiing with him the next morning. They spent the day relaxing above the crystalline depths of Lake Tahoe, drinking beer and eating Bud sandwiches. He bought them a big dinner in Truckee that evening, then drove them back to downtown Reno. For the next 2 weeks, Ron and Dan hung around Sparks and Reno, riding back and forth on the free double-decker shuttle bus, subsisting on the promotional largesse of the gambling industry. They became acquainted with the driver of the shuttle, and he allowed the brothers to sleep in his bus each night, which was a real blessing, Dan says. After his final run in the evening, the driver would have Dan and Ron hide under the seats while he drove into a secure, fenced-in lot in downtown Reno, where he parked the bus overnight. According to Dan, the long padded seats in the back of the bus were real nice for sleeping, considering the alternative. Most days, Dan and Ron bided their time in the cavernous, air-conditioned chambers of the Peppermill Casino. Dan recalls that the Peppermill had a big screen on which they showed the Los Angeles Olympics while we were there, and they also had coupons you could get each day if you had an ID, which gave you a few chips to gamble with and a coupon for a plate of free nachos. I didn't have an ID, but Ron did, and it was our plan to gamble with the free chips to make enough to buy food, which sometimes happened, but usually didn't. After they'd been in Reno a couple of days, the Laffertys were approached by a strange man, according to Dan, who had a beard and rose-colored glasses so you couldn't see his eyes. The fellow gave the brothers a reefer rolled from some excellent weed, asked them a few strange questions, then loaned Dan his ID card, enabling Dan to obtain free gambling chips and nachos. From that point on, Dan says, we had at least 2 plates of nacho chips each day, although that was often all they ate. We were pretty hungry most of the time, Dan concedes, but just when we needed food, someone would offer us something to eat. One couple invited us to their place for a Saturday barbecue, and this kid who was fishing in the little creek that ran through Reno took us for soup and salad at one of the casino specials when we really needed it. And every few days, the strange man in the psychedelic glasses came by to see us and get us high and ask how we were doing. Dan believes even now that this person was an angel sent by God to look after them. During their visit to Reno earlier that summer, Ron and Dan had made the acquaintance of a woman named Debbie, who worked as a blackjack dealer at Circus Circus. She had befriended the brothers and let them crash on her floor. They'd returned the favor by babysitting her young child when she went to work. According to Dan, the brothers had a rather curious, miraculous experience while we were visiting with her. Debbie had bought a puppy for her little boy, and the dog was quite sick with canine parvovirus, a disease much like distemper in cats, usually fatal. Dan placed his hands on the dog's head and gave it a blessing, he says, and it appeared to be instantly healed. I remember how impressed Debbie was. I was too, but tried to act like it was no big deal. Although it might sound like yet another manifestation of Dan's extreme fundamentalist beliefs, performing blessings is an entirely ordinary ritual among mainstream Latter-day Saints. Mormon men will commonly lay hands on the head of a family member or fellow saint and pronounce a blessing in order to heal or to provide comfort in times of stress. Countless Mormons have testified that they were cured of serious illnesses through the laying on of hands. As Kenneth Anderson wrote in a 1999 Los Angeles Times article, this peculiar commingling of mystical as well as historically unsupported doctrines on the one hand and pragmatic rationality on the other is a strong feature of contemporary Mormons as individuals. Educated Mormon culture has long been characterized, for example, by outstanding physical scientists and engineers, as strictly rational as possible in their worldly work, yet devout in their adherence to many historical beliefs that would not pass the test of rational science, and believers, moreover, in deeply mystical ideas, even if they would not represent them as such. My own father spent his career as a chemistry professor and university dean, a dedicated and rational teacher of science. Yet in the Mormon Church, his function, for many years, has been to deliver blessings, to put his hands on the heads of church members and tell them things as moved by God, which are recorded, transcribed, and kept by the church member as a meditative guide to God's intentions for him or her in life. Surely to an outsider this is very close to wild mysticism, yet my father is far indeed from being a wild mystic. Nor is it that he bifurcates his rational life from this mystical experience and has some sort of existential disconnect between them. On the contrary, his experience of giving these Mormon blessings is that the process of following the Spirit is itself reasonable in a way that is highly characteristic of the Mormon trait of perceiving mysticism as a rational practice. When they returned to Reno after the murders, on the run, Ron suggested they stop by Circus Circus and look up Debbie again. Dan warned that he had written about Debbie in his journal, a journal he surmised was by then almost certainly in the possession of the police, so she was probably under surveillance. If we go, he assured Ron, you know we will be arrested. As best I can recall, Dan says, Ron didn't really answer me, but just kept walking toward the casino, where they assumed Debbie would be working her shift, and Dan figured the police would be waiting for them. So, Dan recalls, I said, if it's that time, that's cool. The Lafferty brothers visited Circus Circus early on the afternoon of August 7th, but they didn't see Debbie dealing cards at any of the blackjack tables. According to Dan, he inquired of Ron, should I go and ask for her? Which I knew would spring the trap. Ron told him to go ahead and do it. When Dan approached the pit boss and asked to speak with Debbie, Dan says his eyes got big and he quickly disappeared. At that point, Ron and Dan strolled over to one of the casino's eateries and got in line for the lunch buffet. As they stood in the queue, Dan says he could see men who appeared to be FBI agents peeking around corners and stuff. A moment later, a swarm of police officers rushed up from behind and put guns to our heads and said, "Don't move or we'll blow your brains out." I just smiled. It was kind of fun. Both Lafferty brothers surrendered without a fight and were placed in the Reno jail under extraordinary security. Chapter 23, Judgment in Provo. Critical examination of the lives and beliefs of gurus demonstrates that our psychiatric labels and our conceptions of what is or is not mental illness are woefully inadequate. How, for example, does one distinguish an unorthodox or bizarre faith from delusion? Gurus are isolated people dependent upon their disciples, with no possibility of being disciplined by a church or criticized by contemporaries. They are above the law. The guru usurps the place of God. Whether gurus have suffered from manic depressive illness, schizophrenia, or any other form of recognized, diagnosable mental illness is interesting but ultimately unimportant. What distinguishes gurus from more orthodox teachers is not their manic depressive mood swings, not their thought disorders, not their delusional beliefs, not their hallucinatory visions, not their mystical states of ecstasy. It is their narcissism. Anthony Storr, Feet of Clay. It's August 5th, 2002, a Monday morning, and outside Utah's 4th Judicial District Courthouse, merchants and businessmen are striding purposefully to work in downtown Provo. Although it's still early in the day, the heat is already rising from the pavement in visible waves. Inside the courthouse, the clock on the wall shows 9:21 when the bailiff abruptly shouts, "All rise! The Honorable Stephen Hansen presiding!" The murmur from the gallery subsides, and a moment later a side door swings open, through which 61-year-old Ron Lafferty, attired in orange coveralls with UDC inmates stenciled across the back, is hustled into the courtroom by four armed sheriff's deputies. Ron's reddish-brown hair, now streaked with gray and thinning across the crown, is neatly trimmed. Except for a bushy Yosemite Sam mustache, he is clean-shaven. For the past few months, according to the prison grapevine, he has been obsessively lifting weights and working out. His bulging forearms and thick shoulders appear to confirm the rumor. Ron sits at the defense attorney's table with his hand manacled awkwardly behind his back, staring defiantly at the judge. Looking edgy and hyper-alert, the deputies guarding Ron are taking their responsibilities very seriously. The inmate in their custody has been sentenced to die for viciously murdering a young woman and her baby. They know that at this point he doesn't have a whole lot left to lose. "Good morning, Mr. Lafferty," Judge Hansen says in a formal but amiable voice. "What's up, stupid Stevie?" Ron fires back with an insolent sneer. The judge has started explaining to the inmate why he was summoned from death row to appear before the court this morning when Ron cuts him off. "I know what it's about, you fucking retard." Unruffled, the judge informs Ron that a warrant for his imminent execution has been filed by the state and that he has 30 days to tell the court whether or not he intends to make a last-ditch challenge to his conviction and sentence. If not, an execution date will be set. Judge Hansen also tells Ron that the state will appoint new counsel to shepherd him through the remainder of the appeals process. Ron indicates that his first choice for a new attorney would be Ron Yengich, the lawyer who engineered the controversial plea bargain that spared the life of forger and murderer Mark Hoffman, Dan Lafferty's good friend and cellmate. Ron Lafferty then emphatically declares that he intends to pursue any appeals that are available to me. He makes it clear that he is going to fight the state's efforts to kill him all the way to the bitter end. More than 17 years have passed since Ron was first sentenced in this same courthouse to be shot to death for murdering Brenda and Erica Lafferty, yet here he is, still belligerently among the living. His ongoing legal maneuvers ensure that the agony of Brenda's family is refreshed on a regular basis. "The trials dragging on and on have been hard," admits Lorraine Wright, Brenda's mother. "Some of our children have had quite a struggle, and my husband especially. But that's just the way it goes. We're doing okay now. And we're glad that Brenda's in a better place, out of this cruel world." "Brenda would be 42 now," says Betty Wright McIntyre, Brenda's older sister. "We all still miss her a lot. When they had that first trial, the prosecutors asked us not to attend. They were worried about my dad. They didn't think he could handle it." Immediately following the murders, detectives removed most of Brenda's possessions from the apartment she'd shared with Alan Lafferty as evidence. "After the police had gone through it all, they put the things they didn't need for the investigation into a storage unit," Betty says. "But Alan never paid the rental fee, so the storage company called, and my mother and I drove down to American Fork to take possession of Brenda's stuff. Eventually, my dad started looking through it, her journals and scrapbooks and personal items, and that's when he fell apart. He just cried and cried. Reading what she wrote in her journals, my dad started thinking, why didn't I do something to save her? Why didn't I get her out of there? As her father, he thought he should have been able to protect her somehow, but he couldn't. And now his little girl was gone, and his first grandchild, too. I think he struggled with that for a long time." Capital murder cases must inevitably proceed carefully and deliberately to avoid any chance of a wrongful execution. But the long, slow machinations of American jurisprudence have done little to ease the ongoing suffering of Brenda's father, mother, or siblings. During the original trial, back in 1985, Ron's court-appointed attorney had attempted to mount an insanity defense, hoping for a manslaughter conviction rather than first-degree murder. But Ron had objected to such a stratagem, even though it stood a reasonable chance of saving him from the firing squad. He'd refused to allow any psychiatric testimony to be presented on his behalf. The judge on that occasion, J. Robert Bullock, was concerned that Ron might not fully comprehend the probable outcome of his refusal to consider an insanity defense. So he demanded, "You do understand, Mr. Lafferty, that you are probably leaving the jury with only two choices? To find you guilty of first-degree murder or not guilty?" "I do, Your Honor," Ron answered. "And you understand that if there is a guilty verdict, there will be a penalty hearing?" Judge Bullock asked further. and at that hearing the jury could impose the death sentence. I understand that, Ron replied, but I can't in good conscience, Your Honor, plea bargain. It seems to me that is an admission of guilt. Ron remained resolute in insisting that he wasn't crazy, and he wasn't going to let his lawyer claim otherwise in order to negotiate the murder one charges down to manslaughter. Hamstrung by Ron's obstinacy, his lawyer had to cancel plans to present several witnesses whose testimony would have made a strong case that the defendant was a religious kook. The only witness left for the defense to call was Ron's mother, Claudine Lafferty, who broke down and cried on the stand, then blatantly perjured herself by professing to be unaware that Ron and Dan had talked openly in her presence of killing her daughter-in-law and grandchild. It probably surprised nobody but Ron when the jury returned after deliberating for just 2 hours and 45 minutes and announced that they had found him guilty of all charges, including 2 counts of first-degree murder. Following his conviction, Ron was given a new team of attorneys who appealed to both the U.S. District Court and the Utah Supreme Court. Ron was rebuffed on each occasion, but his lawyers persisted. By 1991, his case had landed in the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver, Colorado, and this court, in a ruling that shocked most of Utah, tossed out Ron's 1985 convictions. In vacating the findings of the state trial court, the 10th Circuit declared that the lower court had bungled things right out of the gate by applying a faulty legal standard when it determined that Ron had been mentally competent to stand trial. Although the judges of the 10th Circuit agreed that Ron understood the charges against him and their possible consequences, they concluded that he was unable as a result of his paranoid, delusional system to interpret them in a realistic way. The bench was troubled by Ron's belief that because he answered to the laws of God, he need not answer to the laws of man. They thought this was a pretty clear indication that the guy was not in his right mind. If the state of Utah wanted to keep him locked up, the judges announced it was going to have to try him again from scratch, after first redetermining whether he was crazy or sane according to accepted legal criteria. The 10th Circuit's ruling had a profound effect on Ron Lafferty and the families of his victims, obviously, but it potentially had even greater ramifications for the manner in which American courts would deal thereafter with violent crimes inspired by religious belief. As Utah Solicitor General Jan Graham explained, "We are concerned about what this decision means not only for the Lafferty case, but for other cases." She warned that it might set a precedent that would immunize religious fanatics from criminal prosecution. Theologians mulled other potential consequences of the 10th Circuit's ruling as well. As Peggy Fletcher Stack, a highly regarded religion writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, pointed out, saying that anyone who talks to God is crazy has enormous implications for the whole world of religion. It imposes a secular view of sanity and means that all religions are insane. This issue was especially germane for Latter-day Saints, given the unusual importance Mormons have always placed on communicating directly with the Almighty. Their entire faith is based on talking to God. The state of Utah was not happy about having to toss out Ron Lafferty's conviction and give him a new trial, but it complied with the 10th Circuit Court's edict, the first phase of which entailed rigorously reassessing Ron's mental competency. The upshot was a hearing in late 1992 wherein a trio of doctors, after examining Ron, convinced the 4th District Court in Provo that he was not fit to stand trial. Having been found incompetent, Ron was transferred from death row at Point of the Mountain to the Utah State Hospital, but the state had no intention of abandoning its efforts to convict and execute him for murder. Following 16 months of psychotherapy, which included putting Ron on a course of antidepressant and antipsychotic medications, another competency hearing was held in February 1994. This time around, the team of shrinks assembled by the prosecution proved more persuasive than the shrinks marshaled by the defense, and Judge Stephen Hansen ruled that Ron was now sufficiently competent to be tried all over again for slaying Brenda and Erica Lafferty. After Ron and Dan had initially been arrested, each of them had made a point of being exceedingly uncooperative with the prosecution. When questioned about the murders, the brothers never failed to be coy and evasive. From the time of their arrest through their 1985 convictions, neither man would confess to anything. By the mid-1990s, however, Dan's attitude and outlook had changed. He accepted that he was going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. Indeed, he believed that his conviction and imprisonment were crucial components of God's plan for mankind. As a consequence, Dan became quite willing, eager even, to talk honestly and openly about exactly what had happened on July 24, 1984. According to Dan's version of events, a narrative considered quite credible for the most part by almost everyone who has heard it, he was the one who cut not only Erica Lafferty's throat, but Brenda's throat as well. Dan insists that Ron didn't actually kill anybody. But even if Ron hadn't wielded the murder weapon, Dan's account clearly placed Ron inside the apartment when the killings happened. Furthermore, Dan now told, in sickening detail, how Ron had savagely beaten Brenda, ignoring her pleas for mercy until her face had been transformed into a pulp of bloody, disfigured flesh. Dan's vivid testimony left no doubt that both brothers were equally culpable for the American Fork murders. Once the jury had an opportunity to hear Dan's testimony during the retrial, Ron would no longer be able to claim, as he had during his 1985 trial, that he'd known nothing about the murders. The retrial was scheduled to commence in March 1996. Ron's attorneys were left with just a single legal option in their attempt to save him from the firing squad, an insanity defense. The same defense they had wanted to use during the 1985 trial, but Ron had forbidden them to employ. As the trial date approached, Ron continued to tell anyone who would listen that he wasn't the least bit crazy, but this time he stopped short of actively preventing his lawyers from arguing to the court that he was insane. Whether Ron lived or died would hinge entirely on whether a jury would be convinced that his religious beliefs, including his certainty that God had commanded the removal of Brenda and Erica Lafferty, were not only sincerely held but also so extreme as to be a delusional artifact of a diseased mind. Such a defense would unavoidably raise the same difficult epistemological questions that had come to the fore after the Tenth Circuit Court's ruling in 1991. If Ron Lafferty were deemed mentally ill because he obeyed the voice of his God, isn't everyone who believes in God and seeks guidance through prayer mentally ill as well? In a democratic republic that aspires to protect religious freedom, who should have the right to declare that one person's irrational beliefs are legitimate and commendable while another person's are crazy? How can a society actively promote religious faith on one hand and condemn a man for zealously adhering to his faith on the other? This, after all, is a country led by a born-again Christian, President George W. Bush, who believes he is an instrument of God and characterizes international relations as a biblical clash between forces of good and evil. The highest law officer in the land, Attorney General John Ashcroft, is a dyed-in-the-wool follower of a fundamentalist Christian sect, the Pentecostal Assemblies of God, who begins each day at the Justice Department with a devotional prayer meeting for his staff, periodically has himself anointed with sacred oil, and subscribes to a vividly apocalyptic worldview that has much in common with key millenarian beliefs held by the Lafferty brothers and the residents of Colorado City. The President, the Attorney General, and other national leaders frequently implore the American people to have faith in the power of prayer and to trust in God's will, which is precisely what they were doing, say both Dan and Ron Lafferty, when so much blood was spilled in American Fork on July 24, 1984. During pretrial hearings, Ron's behavior in the courtroom served to underscore his lawyer's contention that he was mentally incompetent. He appeared with a cloth sign attached to the seat of his prison jumpsuit that read, "Exit Only." His attorneys explained that he wore the sign to ward off the angel Moroni, who Ron believed was an evil homosexual spirit trying to invade his body through his anus. He believed that this same sodomizing spirit had already taken possession of Judge Hansen's body, which is why Ron made a point of shouting profanities at the judge and addressing him with such epithets as Punky Brewster and Fucking Punk. The defense team would try to spare Ron's life by calling as expert witnesses three psychiatrists and one psychologist who would testify that after examining the defendant, they were utterly convinced that he was deranged. The prosecution, on the other hand, would attempt to have Ron executed by presenting one psychiatrist and three psychologists who would argue with no less conviction that Ron was quite sane and had known exactly what he was doing when he'd participated in the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty. The first witness to appear was C. Jess Grosbeck, M.D., a psychiatrist who testified for the defense that Ron had slipped over the edge of sanity when his wife Diana took their children and left him. "It's clear," said Dr. Groesbeck, "that he could not tolerate her loss, triggering the onset of what Groesbeck alternately termed a schizoaffective disorder and a delusional disorder. He based this diagnosis on the fact that Ron's bizarre beliefs could not be changed with reason, and are so fantastic and so beyond any kind of rational acceptance by anyone in the culture that they would be categorized as delusional. When Diana Lafferty left him, Dr. Groesbeck speculated, Ron suffered a total loss of self-esteem or self-image, which prompted him to compensate by creating a new but unreal view of himself and the world. Mike Esplin, Ron's lead attorney, asked Groesbeck, "Do you feel that based on your evaluations that these mental disorders affect his ability, his capacity to comprehend and appreciate the charges or allegations against him?" "I do," Groesbeck answered. "He can't, number one, even evaluate the reality of, for example, the case the state has against him. And number two, I think that even when he can hear a few of those facts, his delusional system is so strong. For example, he absolutely believes that every piece of evidence that has been brought up against him had been planted. And I think that's a product of his delusional thinking. And because of that, in my opinion, he does not meet the criteria of being able to appreciate the charges." The next defense witness, a clinical and forensic psychologist named Robert Howell, seconded Dr. Groesbeck's opinion that Ron suffered from a delusional disorder, a schizophrenic illness that rendered him mentally incompetent to stand trial. Esplin asked Dr. Howell if he had seen evidence of delusion in Mr. Lafferty. Howell replied, "Oh yes, clear back in 1985 and continuing on until now." He pointed out that many of Ron's delusions concerned the state and the family. Ron didn't understand why he was being tried by the state instead of his own family. According to Dr. Howell, Ron considered the issue of his guilt or innocence to be a family matter that could best be resolved by having him duke it out with Alan, the husband of the deceased woman. Dr. Howell went on to describe other delusional behaviors on Ron's part. That he believed Moroni was trying to invade his body through his rectum, that he sometimes heard Christ speaking to him, that he heard a buzzing sound when spirits were present, and that he saw sparks shooting from his fingertips. When it was the prosecution's turn to make its case, however, the battery of expert witnesses the state put on the stand moved quickly to throw cold water on the notion that such behavior demonstrated that Ron was crazy or in any way unfit to stand trial. The first of these experts was Noel Gardner, M.D., a psychiatrist affiliated with the University of Utah Medical School. Dr. Gardner admitted that Ron's belief in travelers, evil spirits, reflector shields, and the like was due to very odd, very strange ideas. The first time I read the defense memorandum describing them, I thought this man may have become psychotic in some way because they sounded so strange. What is interesting, though, is in an in-depth exploration of where those ideas came from and how he uses those ideas and thinks about them, it is very clear to me they are not psychotic ideas. They are very consistent with things he's learned as a child. Gardner explained that Ron described travelers as being spiritual entities with the ability to inhabit different bodies at different times. Gardner pointed out that this belief wasn't really very different from the notion of reincarnation, and that Ron simply used some very unusual labels for a rather conventional set of ideas. There are millions, literally, probably billions of people who believe in a spirit world. Ron talks about what he calls reflector shields, Dr. Gardner testified, warding off or defending against evil forces. And in talking about that, it has the quality that might suggest a psychotic, paranoid set of ideas. But, Gardner continued, Ron actually describes these forces in very much the same kind of language that ordinary religious people would. For example, I asked him how these spirits were alike or different than the idea of guardian angels, and I said I grew up in a family where we believe in guardian angels. Ron responded that his reflector shields were very much like guardian angels, which struck Dr. Gardner as very non-psychotic. It seemed to him to be nearly identical to the ordinary Christian concept of erecting defenses against the temptations or influences of Satan. It's not all that difficult in many ways than a common New Testament text, and it's real clear that many of his ideas have come from his early Mormon religious teachings. Prodding Dr. Gardner to continue in this vein, Utah Assistant Attorney General Creighton Horton asked him, "Are people who believe in divine guidance or believe God sends guardian angels to protect us mentally ill?" "I would hope not," Gardner replied. "Certainly the majority of people in our country believe in God. Most people in our country say they pray to God. It's a common experience. And while the labels that Mr. Lafferty uses are certainly unusual, the thought forms themselves are really very common to all of us.